All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 18 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're moving into the second segment of this course, or part, if you prefer, part two of the course. We've now completed our orientation to ancient history. We now have a means of charting a course from where we are today back into the furthest recesses of recorded history, and to get from whatever corner of history we do immerse ourselves in all the way back to where we are, and always to be able to navigate back and forth so that we don't fall into the trap of exploring the past as if it were a value in and of itself, as if just accumulating facts about the past is some sort of meaningful human activity. What we are getting in position to be able to do with something as distant and seemingly disconnected from the present day as ancient history, what we are now in a position to do is to collect together an organized, integrated body of knowledge and to build a really well-ordered, structured awareness of the past. So Rosie asks, are we going to be doing the timeline yet? Yeah, we're going to be periodically doing a facts practice in class, and I will announce the facts practice the day before. You know, so if you are working on this on a regular basis, I suspect some of you are already basically, you know, in complete command of the material here, so you're probably not practicing it on a daily basis. If you do need to practice because you're not able to complete it in about 2 minutes or so, then certainly you should be on a daily basis. And every once in a while, we'll give you an opportunity in class to just do a checkup and see, okay, how fast are you? How quickly can you, reproduce this information, basically? So that's hopefully the answer to that question, Rosie. But we'll be referring back to this timeline, and I'm going to be honing it. I'm going to be trying to represent it in some new fashion. Somebody sent me a suggestion about how to visualize it in a manner that might be a little bit easier to make sense of. So yeah, I'm still working on that particular aspect. So I'll do that. But basically, you know, we're going to return to this throughout the entire year. And over the course of the year, we are going to add to it. We are definitely going to, you know, find that there are things that we are going to encounter in the past that also deserve to be remembered, that things that will help us to understand that past and its connection to us. And thus we will continue to add to this timeline. But now that we are in this position, though, we're ready to proceed to the next phase. We're ready in particular to do something that is otherwise quite challenging, and which I myself, you know, I will readily confess to you, have struggled with a great deal in my studies. I've been working on history on a professional level for over 20 years now. And one of the challenges that I've faced and have not been able to, up until this point really, to my own complete satisfaction, figure out is how to understand ancient history and how to study it in the sense of how to learn it and present it and teach it in a way that it is more than just a bunch of facts about stuff that happened a long time ago. Because I tell you, I can't tell you how many books I've read. It's just torture. Especially books on ancient Egypt or similar subjects. It's just torture, to figure out what to do with just the vast amount of information that has been generated by archaeologists and historians and so on. And it just doesn't matter to anybody but them. and it's just excruciatingly difficult to extract the real meaning of it all for us here and now. It's a great challenge. And we are already in really great shape in this course, though. I'm very pleased with the way things have gone this year. I think they've gone better than ever in terms of ancient history. We started with, this building this bridge back to the classical world and becoming familiar with this particular here, this axis of history, that flows through the Dark Ages and the Renaissance through to us here in the present. And this is a very powerful link here. This essentially is the spine of history right here, the central conduit of all of history. And so to know that is to know a great deal. And then we have also done really well in the sense that we have identified that ancient Egypt is an archaic culture, which is of a different order than all of the classical ones, Greece and Rome being the two essential ones there. And that's a whole other project. This is something that I've always felt kind of instinctively or implicitly about ancient history, is that it's not all created equal. It's not all equally important and worthy of study. And I've tried to, in History at Our House, I've always tried to design the program in such a way that we focus on the most important stuff. But this year, I think more than ever before, we have a good structure to it. And the structure of it, in case you're wondering kind of like what the year is going to look like here, I don't mind. I think it might be just a worthwhile preview just for your sake, so you know what we're going to do. I'm sorry, I keep doing the wrong thing. I just want to bring up a notepad. So the structure of the course this year is going to be the following, which is a little bit different than probably is even in the syllabus. So we got part one, right? Orientation to ancient history. And then we got part two, which is what we are about to embark on, archaic cultures. And what you're going to see there is that it's going to be Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Persia. All right, and so we're going to spend one part of the course on that, 6 weeks. And then we will do part three. We'll do archaic Greece, because that's special and different. This is an approximate breakdown. And then an entire segment dedicated to just classical Greece. And then part five will be the Roman Republic. And part six will be the Roman Empire. So that's the structure of our course. And I'm really excited about this, because it's become a really good measure kind of how important Greece and Rome are. Right? Just Greece and Rome, each of them by itself, is easily twice as important as the entire sum of all of these cultures. And so that's a pretty good measure right there in terms of the structure of the course. We're going to focus on the most important stuff. This, to me, is me delivering on the promise that, the motto of History at Our House used to be, important is the most important word in history. Well, in other words, what I always promise to you guys is that I'm going to strive to present the most important material and not waste your time with stuff that isn't important. This outline here of the course, which has really been honed now to this point where all of the archaic cultures are basically in one segment only. Okay, we're going to be studying three different ones. One, Egypt is certainly unique. And then all of the various cultures of Mesopotamia and Persia kind of go together. So each of them will get about 3 weeks worth of discussion and presentation. And that's it. Then we move on to the stuff that really matters. Okay, so that is the design of the course here. And so then, how do we study this? This archaic part of history. We've got a bridge. We know what it is. We wouldn't know anything about it if we hadn't built that bridge, which is a pretty amazing accomplishment. But we still run the risk of spending too much time over here when ultimately this goes to here and it's over. And there is nothing in this modern, globalized, America-centric world that really directly reflects any of the things that happened over here. So that is then kind of the challenge, is how do we study archaic history present-centrically? So if you're writing notes, and this is certainly a very good question to prod you on a theoretical level for you students at the high school level. That's the question. How do you study archaic history present-centrically? Because it's easy to... It's easier to answer the question, how do you study ancient history present-centrically? Because ancient history includes the classical past, and the classical cultures of Greece and Rome have transmitted values that continue to animate civilization today. So if what they did is still relevant to us, we still agree with them, we still honor what they did and copy them, then, of course, it makes sense to study what they did, because they're the ones who created in the first place. We wouldn't be where we are without them. But we can't say that about the archaic cultures. We can't say that about Egypt. So then, that's the puzzle. How do you study archaic history present-centrically? Anybody have a guess? Or some sort of prediction or advanced notion of what to do, you know, before we dive into it? What's your expectation? Theo, go ahead.
Well, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We have to connect it to something so that we can connect it to the present, I think.
All right, and a good answer. Okay, we have to look for connections. Absolutely. Okay, by connections, so we can state that in a variety of different ways, right? But that's a really good key word, right? And we have to build that. Rosetta Stone is a connection, right? So we have a connection. But the question is a little bit more difficult than that. You're on the right track, Theo, in the sense that you've got the right approach. We've got to be looking for connections. And so what connections exist, right? And linguistically, the bridge is the Rosetta Stone. Okay. But what is our connection to ancient Egypt is a question that really boils down to a quite obvious fact. The connection is very limited, first of all. So one thing, you know, that I'm going to say, which is reflected in the outline of the course, is that part of the answer, how do you study ancient history archaic history present-centrically is, this is a joke answer, but very carefully, to put it perhaps a little bit more meaningfully, you would say you study it very selectively, because since it is archaic, It is full of stuff that has no connection. So studying it is going to be, it's very easy to fall into the trap of studying it for its own sake. Which, by the way, if you didn't know, there's a good word for that. We, is not equal to, I think that's the symbol for not equal to, antiquarianism. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's the not equal to sign. Or may as well just put, is not antiquarianism. So, the studying ancient things for their own sake, that's antiquarianism. It's basically abandoning the present, not seeking any significance whatsoever, just merely diving into the past and basically living in the past. Juliet, what did you want to say?
Well, I was going to say that one of the connections is that they all had monarchies, but today in America we don't have monarchy.
All right.
We have a government based on classical governments.
Okay, that's a very good anticipatory answer right there. And so what you're doing there, Juliet, is you are making a connection. So we're giving some substance to what Theo said, right? Theo said, broadly speaking, philosophically, what we need is connections, right? And then the question is, okay, well, what connections? What kinds of connections? And what are the ones that matter to us? And you're suggesting, well, one of the connections that we can make in it to any part of the past is to compare the types of institutions, the type, in particular, the types of governments that people have with the ones that we have now. And this is a constant in the sense that every recorded civilization has a government. And we know the significance of government. If we look around the world and we compare societies, and one of the reasons why we have a timeline like this that has these multiple colored axes on it, right, is for me to challenge you to think of the world that you're living in as a sum. And we can look at this big yellow progression down here at the bottom, and we can think about a civilization like China that extends way, way back continuously. And we can look at its government, and and that's at one model out there in the world today. And in that model, for what it's worth, is a bad model, and it's not going to succeed. A lot of people out there who should know better but don't have this notion that China is going to become the most important country in the world somehow and displace the United States. This is a strangely naive idea that reflects that people don't understand the importance of government. The Chinese government is not a good model for government. It's just not. And it's not going to be able to govern the country to that point that it's going to create the world is not going to become China-centric, as far as I can see. Until such time as maybe this green line over here results in a radical transformation of Chinese culture, which is possible, but I don't foresee it for my lifetime or yours. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. And so this is the connection you're making, Juliet, is to a universal theme. And that's a really great connection to make. Because history is this massive database of information concerning things that are important to all human beings, no matter their circumstance, no matter their background, no matter their skin color, no matter their gender, no matter what. It demonstrates things that are universally true concerning human beings. And this particular truth that you're connecting to there, Juliet, so adeptly there, Aristotle once, who was a Greek philosopher, once named it. He said, man is a political animal. So what he meant was that politics, the nature of government, which is to say government, is a human need. It's not optional. Human beings need governments. Which is why there is not a single civilization in existence or ever has been in one in all of recorded history that did not have a government. And another important thing about archaic history is notice that what happened in 3000 BC? When does history begin for Egypt? To make this connection. Juliet, keep going with it.
When Menes Narmer reunified Egypt.
And creating what for the entire country?
A complete government.
A government.
Single government.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's very interesting that, in fact, if you look at Chinese history, which is another good example of an archaic culture, or Russian history, or European history, or any part of history, India is a strange exception to this fact, but wherever you look, the first event in history pertains to the formation of a government. And only then do you get a civilization that leaves any permanent mark of itself. Before that, for however long human beings have been there, they didn't do anything that was significant enough to result in any permanent trace. Yeah, so one of the things that is of universal concern to human beings is the nature of government. And so we can use that truth that we can glean from history to go back to ancient history and have a theme to pursue. We want to know more about that because our classical connection comes through government, Greece and Rome. Democracy, republic, these really important concepts. And then, okay, well, why is Egypt archaic? What, if we're going to study the archaic world, well, let's do so with kind of that in mind, that there's something going on there. It's not classical, but it's something that can concern us and be of interest to us as we look back. So that's a kind of connection, which is really good. All right, but I'm gonna propose to you that our connection is much simpler than that. In fact, and or at least that's not what I mean to say. I want to be more precise. Our connection to ancient Egypt involves that theme, but it's much more obvious. In other words, we don't have to use all these abstractions and discuss all these these concepts and so on in order to grasp the connection. The connection is much more, it's literally visible. And that, to me, is a great, great help. I think it is the ultimate. It's another kind of bridge. It's the ultimate gateway into the past of the Egyptians. And it's as simple as this. How do we study the past present centrically? What is our present day connection to the Egyptians? Juliet, your answer is a good one. So this answer that Theo and Juliet combined kind of gave us a good answer. They said, okay, we've got to seek a connection, right? And it probably has to do with government because that's a really universal human theme. That's excellent. Okay, true. That's very abstract though. Right? So, there's an easier way. And this is it. Because what of the ancient Egyptians connects us to them? Or rather, I should say, connects them to us. What was it? What trace of their civilization was left that reflects their culture and allows us then to have a conduit back to them and ask questions and feel connected to them in any way, Rosie?
Their pyramids and what they left and their pyramids and stuff.
Yeah, what they left behind, that thing. I mean, you know, we are connected to the Greeks and Romans because they taught us how to think about government. All right, that's a connection. But the Egyptians didn't do that for us. What did they do? What they did is they left behind these gigantic pyramids. They're colossal. They're just astounding creations. They're by far the most astounding colossal works of archaic history. They really are astounding. Here we have, you know, for scale in the foreground, some people down here, right? And with some camels and donkeys and what have you. And for over 4,000 years, the Egyptian pyramids were the tallest man-made structures in the world. Just for fun, because I'm a big skyscraper buff, I pulled this thing off the internet here of the it's a very, very compressed timeline of the world's tallest buildings, but basically for 4,000 years the so-called Great Pyramid of Giza was the tallest structure in the world. In between that and the Eiffel Tower there were a whole bunch of different ones. In particular, Gothic cathedrals in Europe, their spires could sometimes reach, you know, in this range over here. But then you've got the Eiffel Tower that reaches up. This is in meters here, you know, to about twice as high as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Then you've got the Empire State Building; it's almost three times as high, and so on. And today, we have this structure in Dubai today, which is just absolutely mind-boggling in terms of how high it is. Just absolutely amazing. So, but, you know, for 4,000 years, this was the standard. It didn't get any bigger than that. Right? So, going back to this, right? This is the thing that the Egyptians did that connects us to them. That, to me, is the best answer possible. We wouldn't really have a reason to dedicate ourselves to the study of Egyptology. You know, there wouldn't be such a science. There wouldn't be this obsession. And much of what we have discovered about ancient Egypt, there just wouldn't have been a reason to do it. Had there not been these mysterious colossal works of ancient engineering to spur us to want to know. Now, we did know to some extent. The ancient Greeks, even before we began our modern studies of Egyptology, the ancient Greeks were familiar. You know, they traded the Mediterranean. We saw the Port of Land chart, which captures kind of the Mediterranean trade, the importance of Mediterranean trade. The Greeks traded with the Egyptians and the Romans and so on. The whole Mediterranean world was quite interconnected. The Greeks were aware of it. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus, my personal hero, wrote about ancient Egypt. He collected together all the stories that were told. He wanted to teach the Greeks about the Egyptians. And in his work called The Histories Nowadays, ancient title was more like The Inquiries, but in his book, he did research on Egypt, and what he was told by the Egyptians was that it had taken 100,000 men 20 years to build each one of these big pyramids. It Each one of the central complex, because you got the small ones in the, this is, these are the small ones here, but the big ones required 20 years of labor by 100,000 men to construct. So what more could you ask for? if you want to know about a culture, what more could you ask for? Right? Because I have dedicated 20 years of my life to the study of history. What does that tell you about my values? Right? I mean, that is my professional existence. It is my top value. So I've spent more than 20 years on it. So that's a really good measure of who I am and what is important to me. So if we want to know about the Egyptians, and we want to have, you know, want to understand them and figure out, okay, what connection might there be between us, then what better way than through this gateway to their culture? Right? The Egyptians were the pyramid builders. I mean, that is, in essence, what they are to history. They did not transmit their values to us. We do not live in an Egyptian way. But what they did do was build these things that led us to want to know them more, better. To want to uncover their story and find out, you know, to get a good appreciation for why did they do this and how did they do this? Who were these people, these pyramid builders? That's it. That's our connection. The pyramids. So not surprisingly, the pyramids are going to be one of our anchor facts when we get to a more detailed awareness of them. But basically, the pyramids are a lens for studying ancient Egypt because they really reveal the essence of this archaic culture, as we will see. And they really do help us to focus on what we need to understand about them. And then when we get to the Greeks and the Romans, we'll see what was different about them and how come one of these or two of these perhaps are classical versus archaic. You know, what's the difference? What's the, for instance, and another interesting question that we can go with, you know, Theo and Juliet were challenging us to look for connections. Here's another interesting connection or another theme that we can pursue. What was the missing ingredient or ingredients in Egyptian culture? Why did a culture like that not succeed in transmitting itself? Why is it gone? Whereas on the other hand, the Greeks and the Romans, what they thought, we still accept. Theo, maybe you want to take that on a preliminary basis? Go ahead.
Well, their government wasn't free, so it wouldn't last.
All right. You're on the right track. You're on the right track. So we'll get to that. Okay. So the pyramids. What about them? We know 100,000 people, according to Herodotus and the ancient Egyptians themselves, 100,000 people labored 20 years to build one of these. Okay, first thing to know about that is 100,000 laborers. Okay, what kind of laborers? Juliet?
Farmers, peasants, normal people.
Yes, but that is not precise. Because, Abby?
Slaves.
They were slaves. They did not do it voluntarily. All right? So, very important fact concerning ancient Egyptian culture was the pervasive presence of slavery. And here we have a painting that's entitled Israel in Egypt because stories of the Old Testament and stories of ancient history speak to the fact that conquered populations, such as the people of Israel, would then be taken back to Egypt, enslaved, and put to work So it wasn't always the case that it was conquered populations. As Juliet points out, farmers and kind of regular people, as you might say, were co-opted by the government to build the pyramids. So it wasn't always foreign laborers. It was some mix thereof. So, in other words, the leaders of Egypt, that we call the pharaohs, I think everybody here is more than familiar with that term. If you're not, stop me. Right? The rulers of Egypt. Here's the pharaoh under the nice, shade over here in the back, wearing a certain kind of helmet that we'll have to learn more about as well. It's not Upper or Lower Egypt. It's a different one. So the pharaohs could command the apparatus of government to enslave 100,000 people and organize them into a workforce over the course of 20 years in order to build the pyramids. I mean, that is amazing in a sense, right? Because is there anything comparable nowadays? Can one kind of imagine a 20-year construction project by 100,000 people? Rosie, you've got something?
Well, I was going to say was that usually after the people, like, even if they were just normal farmers and then the pharaoh said somebody to tell them that they had to come build a pyramid or something, usually after that they had to go back and do it another one after they finish.
Well, there you go, right? So basically, the enslavement of the population was a regular feature of existence. And you had there was a kind of rhythm to life where as we'll talk about, you would have kind of an agricultural cycle where you could plant your crops and, you know, make sure that there was enough food for the country. And then when that cycle was basically taken care of, then you were required to provide your personal labor to the pharaoh. And yeah, so the whole, you know, apparatus of slavery on that level, it was extremely organized kind of system, right? And then of course, who knows what percentage of them died on any given day and what population had to be replenished and so on in order to continue the project. We don't have data on that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it was just an absolutely colossal undertaking. And, that's one of the things that we have to contend with, concerning this archaic culture that built these, is that 100,000 slaves could be deployed by the pharaoh in order to build this. And build what? What did he make them build? Abby?
He made them build a pyramid, which was basically a tomb.
A tomb.
South.
Okay, right, exactly. A place to put his dead body. Okay, so now what does this tell us? Now, it's not just a tomb, in a sense. Yes, it is a tomb, right? But what more? What does this reveal about the culture of ancient Egypt? The death of the pharaoh was a massive event, right? The colossal engineering works of the Egyptians were focused on the death of the pharaoh. Just that, though? Is that it? Why? What do we learn from studying them, Theo?
Well, the Egyptians believed that the pharaohs were gods, and the pyramids were to help them move on to the afterlife.
Okay, very good. So that's really, really crucial. If we're going to properly characterize the purpose of this, you know, colossal cultural effort, it wasn't just dedicated to the burial of the pharaoh's body. It was dedicated, these pyramids were dedicated to the proposition, the belief, that the pharaoh had a supernatural aspect or identity. And that if the pharaoh entombed in the pyramids was properly cared for in ritualistic fashion, that he would then ascend to the heavens and look over and care for Egypt in perpetuity. So that's the perfect place for us to stop for today, in the sense that now we have a window into Egypt. As we study the story here of what happened, we will learn that the Egyptians built about 100 of these pyramids for pharaohs. So they took it really seriously. 100 pharaohs, that's a lot. It wasn't, the age of pyramids lasted about 500 years. And they built them, and they built them, and they built them. And so they were really committed to this. This was not like a one-time deal, right? There was a culture. A culture is a persistent way of life, shared by people who are conjoined in a certain area, live together, generation after generation, transmitting values to each other. So this is a very persistent human collective, historical evolution of culture. For 500 years, the Egyptians did this. They took it very seriously. So this is what we want to understand about them. Why did they do that? What's the significance of it? What we'll see is they eventually gave up, stopped doing it. That's also very interesting. Eventually they disappeared altogether. The entire culture evaporated. Or maybe that's not the right metaphor. The entire culture was overrun and eventually disappeared under pressure from other cultures. So it'd be interesting to follow that through. Abby, final thoughts for today?
I just wanted to mention something that was kind of interesting and strange about the Egyptian culture is that, you know, for example, today we spend our lives preparing for different moments in our lives. They spent their lives preparing for death. Mm-hmm. And not their death. And for most people, it wasn't their death. It was somebody else's death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that is an interesting remark. And the one qualifier that you have to put on that, Abby, is that it's true to say, from a worldly perspective, that the moment of the pharaoh's death was really the central event in the entire Egyptian culture. But that was viewed, and you have to respect that it was viewed as a moment of transition. So that's where we're going to get into the question of Egyptian culture and its religious aspect, how could, this was not, in philosophical terms, if you had a culture that was, that worshipped death as such, that we would call that nihilism. And the Egyptian culture was not nihilistic. The point was that there was a belief in the afterlife that was so strong, so pervasive, so culturally embedded in the way of life that's all we have left of them. that's how seriously they took it. So yeah, that becomes another connection. That becomes another interesting theme to pursue. All right, well, we'll do that. We'll look at the life in ancient Egypt and how it had this supernatural dimension, this supernatural kind of aspect to it in virtually every regard, and consequently how it could be that the culture would then be so focused on the afterlife, on the supernatural qualities of the pharaoh, and dedicate itself in such measure to the building of the pyramids. All right, we'll pick this up tomorrow. By the way, the test one grading keys will be on the class webpage today. Okay, so just look for those, right? If you go to the class webpage and you go to the October one, you will see, the coming soon link, and that'll be on there along with the recordings today. Okay, so as soon as the recordings are posted, the test one grading key will also be there. Did I do that while it was visible? No, I probably didn't do that. Oops, I was trying to show you guys that. If you go to the October webpage, you will see this is what it looks like right now. You'll see it says coming soon. By the end of the day, the grading key will be there. Okay? All right, thanks everybody. We'll take a look at life in ancient Egypt tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.